It is Monday, March 7th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Just ahead, VOA's Pentagon reporter gives us new details of a U.S. drone strike that killed scores of al-Shabaab Islamist militants in Somalia. We'll be hearing from our correspondents in northern Iraq and eastern Ukraine as they speak to people struggling to cope with displacement from years of conflict. Find out what to expect in the Wall Street Trading Week with financial correspondent Jill Malandrino, and I'll speak with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about the retirement of an American football quarterback who just won his second Super Bowl. It's all ahead on International Edition. The U.S. Defense Department says a U.S. airstrike in central Somalia has killed more than 150 al-Shabaab militants who are preparing for a large-scale attack. For more on this developing story, I spoke with our Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, and I asked her how the U.S. military was able to take out so many militants in one operation.
Well, the United States was using both manned and unmanned aircraft for a strike in this town. It's about 200 kilometers north of the capital, Mogadishu. And when they went into this, they'd been looking at this for weeks. The Pentagon says that they had eyes on this training facility for several weeks and had noticed that they were ready to complete their training, and so they decided to strike. And they came in, according to locals, they came in on two swoops, about three strikes each. And the Pentagon says they took out about 150 terrorist fighters. There had been up to 200 terrorist fighters in that compound throughout the time that they had been watching it. They said locals say that the death toll may not be quite so high. They're reporting around 70 militants killed, but then there are dozens more wounded, and locals also say that the casualty total could rise as we find out what happens to these people who are wounded at the time.
Do we have any idea what kind of plan these al-Shabaab fighters had?
Well, the United States isn't giving too many details, but what they said is that it looked like they were going to have a large-scale attack that could be targeting some of the African Union members and U.S. forces, because while the United States doesn't really talk a lot about the U.S. forces in Somalia, there is a small number in there advising some of these African Union forces that are fighting against al-Shabaab.
How common is it for the U.S. military to carry out these kinds of operations in Somalia?
This is fairly common. The United States has said that if al-Shabaab is going to continue carrying out terrorist attacks, that the United States has every right to strike them and is working with the Somali government to strike them. One that was very high profile was, of course, the death of the group's longtime leader, Ahmed Abdi Gadane. That was back in September 2014. So these are not too frequent, but they're enough to say that they're regular.
What else do we know about the U.S. Strategy against al-Shabaab?
Well, the United States has come out multiple times today. In fact, I just got out of a briefing with the Secretary of the Air Force, Deborah Lee James, who says that this is a defensive strategy, that they saw, instead of this being an offensive attack against al-Shabaab, they see this as something that was defensive in nature because they were planning this attack. They had shown that they were training for this particular large-scale attack, and therefore it is the United States' responsibility to protect its own in Somalia as well as its allies. So that kind of shows you how the policy is going here. The United States doesn't want to become actively involved in Somalia. This goes back to policy for all of Africa. They feel that they do not need to be somebody who comes in and takes over. They want to be there for help and only for help. So this policy is a perfect example of that, coming in, taking out dozens, more than 100 potentially, of these attackers, and then kind of working behind the scenes to guide some of the African Union people.
Well, thank you very much to our Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb, for bringing us that report.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, up next, we have our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, in the studio with me to tell us what people are saying about the drone strike. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
Well, how big is the story on Twitter?
Not very much, but I expect more as time passes, and the Boston Globe was one of the first to tweet about it, along with Foreign Policy and MSNBC. And I could definitely find more reactions to that story on Facebook.
Okay, well, what are people saying on Facebook?
So NBC News posted as many as 100 members of the Al-Shabaab terrorist group were killed by U.S. airstrikes in Somalia overnight Sunday, citing senior defense officials. Now, a reply to that post reads like this. In the coming weeks, it will be reported it wasn't 100 militants, it wasn't 50. It will end up as two mule carts and a few peddlers on their way to market. So you can definitely see some people are distrustful of the information they find.
Distrustful and cynical, huh?
Very cynical regarding drone strikes. But another person replied, as a Somali, I'd much rather if the U.S. didn't get involved in these conflicts. Yes, Al-Shabaab should be dealt with, but the Somali government should be the one to do it. Now, to that, there were many replies telling him that clearly the Somali government failed to do that, so Washington had to step in.
Okay, well, what other news is trending on the web today?
So people are still talking about Sunday night's Democratic debate and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders faced off in Flint, Michigan. And as you know, Michael, that water contamination crisis there is huge.
It is.
And both candidates called for accountability. Documentary filmmaker Michael Moore was live tweeting during the debate, and one of his tweets highlighted the importance of the venue. He tweeted, "It's rare a debate airs from a city this poor or this black. But never has there been a presidential debate in front of an audience this poisoned." I like to also highlight that he is a left-leaning activist.
He is,
so that
yes.
kind of affects like what he puts out on Twitter.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. And after the debate, Clinton shared a clip from the night, the one about her thoughts on gun manufacturers. Bernie Sanders, for his part, didn't really refer to the debate on Twitter, but that's not very unusual because he's not as prolific as Clinton on Twitter, as you know.
And Clinton has a much bigger Twitter following.
She has, and she's more. I don't know if you noticed, but she's very savvy, and she uses a lot of like new tools, like polls and multimedia elements to it. Bernie Sanders, usually just links and wording.
Right. So maybe he has some catching up to do. Well, thank you very much to G. Abby Lee for that Twitter roundup. She is on Twitter and Facebook roundup, of course. She's on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. And I'm on there as well at Michael_Lippin. And, of course, you can find this show on Twitter, too. We are at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Green Beat for a healthier planet.
Three. Only three northern white rhinos remain on Earth, and only one of them is a male who is 43 years old and too weak to procreate on his own. But rhino keeper Zachariah Matai says Sudan, named for the country of his birth, is still very social.
Yeah, he really enjoyed being wrapped under the belly. Sometimes behind the ears, he feels it's okay.
The three rhinos reside at a conservation site in central Kenya, where they are protected from poachers by armed guards. Rhino horns are in great demand in parts of Asia where they are believed to have medicinal properties. They don't.
It doesn't cure anyone at all. So, but what we are doing is that we are creating awareness to everyone to see the importance of conserving such kind of an animal.
Researchers say they hope to bring the rhinos back from the brink of extinction through in vitro fertilization with a southern white rhino, acting as a surrogate mother. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. With the war in Syria underway now for 5 years, refugees who fled to neighboring Iraqi Kurdistan see little reason for optimism about the future. VOA's Sharon Bain reports from the Iraqi town of Domiz, 60 kilometers from the Syrian border, where thousands of Syrian Kurds are living in cement huts, dreaming of an escape to Europe, regardless of the risks.
No one believed that after 4 years, their children would still be refugees, playing on dirt streets like this one. There are some 30,000 Syrians in this camp, one of many in the region. Like for everyone here, the war in Syria shattered Khalisa Sabri Ali's life. In Syria, she had a house, her husband had a job, their kids were supposed to go to college. Now, they have nothing.
My son was doing so well in school, but I had to send him to work in the camp. He is our only source of income.
Syria, she says, is gone.
What was called Syria does not exist anymore. There is nothing now. It is all in ruins. I have no hope that Syria will return to normal. There is no hope. There is nothing. Forget about Syria.
Shopkeeper Hussein Ali says thousands have already left this camp looking for a better future in Europe. Ali's daughter was one of the ones who left. She never made it. She drowned in the boat crossing. He says Syrians have little choice.
I do not see any future here. Things are getting worse. We may have a chance at a better life in Europe, but staying here, it will be even worse.
After 4 years of war, donor money is dropping off. Refugees who stay face a future of crowded housing, fewer jobs, and little to offer their children. Many would agree with Sabri Ali. There is no future here. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Dumis.
On to another conflict now. 2 years into Ukraine's war, many of the people caught in the middle of it see the conflict as frozen and forgotten by the rest of the world. With diplomatic efforts failing so far, many see the only ways of ending the war as either an escalation or the relinquishing of territory. VOA Europe correspondent Luis Ramirez reports from the Donetsk region of eastern Ukraine.
Much of eastern Ukraine still bears the scars of the worst days of this war at its start in 2014. When Olga Leshishkina's home was shelled and her business destroyed, her family had to try to start over.
At least for my children, I do not want them to experience the same. Of course, I understand we can't bring back what we had before, this is for sure, but at least let's not try to make it worse for anyone.
Her family moved down the road to another town, Kramatorsk. Then the shells fell here, too.
I was terrified there and here. The same hell was happening. You think that in this place there is peace, and then the same process begins here.
Olga is one of the fortunate ones because she at least found an apartment to stay in. Many others end up at shelters like this one, run by volunteers. These days, economic conditions are driving many from the war zone. With mines closed or flooded, jobs are gone. For many, leaving is the only alternative to joining separatist groups. The conflict is stuck, and so are people's lives.
We do not need a frozen conflict in Ukraine. We need the release of our territories, the return of the borders. As we have war in Ukraine, we have to use military methods to win this war. So it is not possible to just stall this war. We can only either win it or lose it.
Olga is trying to create a normal life for her family as best she can and praying for a miracle.
There is anxiety, but still we are trying to fight. Looking at our new generation, my soul is happy and singing, thinking that everything will be all right. This is all that I want.
A new major offensive may begin at any time, and both sides are preparing. As we head away from the war zone, a long Ukrainian army convoy heads to the front. After 2 years, the end is nowhere in sight.
The way many of the people I spoke with here see it, this is a proxy war between the West and Putin, a deadly game in which they are caught in the middle, thousands of lives lost and thousands more shattered. Everyone wants it to end soon, but no one knows how that end will come. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, in the Donetsk region of eastern Ukraine.
This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
Scientists have found evidence of the rare element curium in a carbon-rich meteorite. This radioactive element is not known to occur naturally on Earth, but instead is manufactured or is produced as the side effect of a nuclear explosion. Curium wasn't discovered until 1944, when Glenn Seaborg and his colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, created the element after bombarding the atoms of plutonium with alpha particles. The researchers who detail their discovery in the journal Science Advances suggest that the curium wound up in the meteorite during the formation of the solar system after a gaseous cloud that went on to create the sun condensed. The researchers say that they believe that finding this rare material in a meteorite may cause scientists to reconsider current models of stellar evolution and nucleosynthesis, which is a change in the chemical composition of a star. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. U.S. stock indexes on Wall Street made only small gains on Monday, putting the brakes on a three-week rally. Earlier, I spoke to our financial correspondent in New York, Jill Malandrino, who told me what traders will be watching as the new markets week unfolds.
Well, what everyone's going to look for is to see the continuation of the three-week gains that we've seen in the market. Going into trade on Monday morning, we opened up about 7 to 8 points lower on the S&P for the index to come back and rally up about 7 to 8 points. We're about flat right now as the market goes into the last hour of trading. What you're seeing the bullish action is in the energy space. Crude today traded over $38 in the middle of the session. This is a big move, Michael, because it has moved $6 higher just in the past 5 days. Percentage-wise, that's a tremendous move for the commodity, considering it has sold off so significantly from the June 2014 highs. In terms of getting new money into the market, we still see a lot of cash on the sidelines, which is why you're getting this choppy, unconstructive trade. We're not seeing fresh money come into the market, but what we call sector rotation. So, for example, we're seeing money come out of tech or consumer, some of the utility names, because they performed better than energy or the financials in the beginning of the year. So it's really just shifting around where investors have been putting their money today. Energy following on how the commodity crude is performing. So that's why you're seeing some strength there. But I think until we see some more defined leadership in the market or we see fresh money come in, we'll probably be trading like this for some time.
And what is driving up the oil price in the last couple of days?
To be honest with you, nobody has any idea because fundamentals are as weak as they have been. We're still producing at record levels. We are oversupplied to the point where we're running out of storage because there have been no production cuts, whether it's OPEC or non-OPEC. Why crude is moving so much higher as it has been really is anyone's guess. Traders I speak with think it could be more of a technical level, meaning that traders are using different levels on the charts to determine their positions rather than looking at the fundamentals, which in my mind and many people's minds are very weak because we're so oversupplied. Even if we did get a significant production cut, we still have to get all of that supply out of the system. The only other bullish factor I can think of in the United States, we're coming up to the strong seasonal demand in the summer with the driving season, but it was weak last year, so it's really anyone's guess until we start to see a drawdown in the actual products.
Okay, well, thank you very much to our financial reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino, for bringing us that Wall Street update.
All right, thank you very much.
Now to U.S. sports. One of the top National Football League quarterbacks of our time, Peyton Manning, is retiring. Manning, who just led the Denver Broncos to a Super Bowl win, made the announcement on Monday after an NFL career lasting 18 seasons. Joining me in the studio with more is Jim Stevenson, who in a previous life covered sports for VOA. Is that true? The rumors are true?
That is indeed, Michael. Peyton Manning, by the way, called the Broncos late Saturday to inform him that he would be retiring. This news conference on Monday had previously been scheduled for the Broncos, but they didn't know what Manning's decision would be, if he would continue to play with the team or if he would indeed retire. They did not know that until he called them. Manning is credited with transforming the overall game into a more pass-oriented contest, and he also brought a sense of dignity and work ethic to the National Football League at a time when there were drug scandals and off-the-field incidents, and they were severely tarnishing the professional game's image. By the way, his little brother Eli came to the field after Manning, and he himself won two Super Bowls for the New York Giants. They are both the sons of former New Orleans Saints quarterback Archie Manning, and so with Peyton, there was a link with the past and also a vision for the future of the game.
And maybe a little sibling rivalry too, huh?
Absolutely, because baby brother got his two rings first before Peyton did.
Right.
Peyton Manning played 18 seasons. 14 of those came with the Indianapolis Colts, 4 with the Denver Broncos. His teams made the playoffs in 15 of his 18 seasons. That's how good he was. He reached the coveted 4,000-yard passing mark in just 14 seasons. The Colts had years before, when Manning was just a little kid, he was 8 years old, they moved from Baltimore to Indianapolis. And when Indianapolis inevitably made that first trip back to play the new team that was there, the Ravens, Peyton was able to meet one of his football idols, NFL quarterback legend Johnny Unitas. And Peyton recalled that encounter during his emotional retirement announcement Monday with the media.
I had met him once before, but when the game was over, I had a chance to shake Johnny Unitas' hand. He told me, "Peyton, you stay at it. I'm pulling for you." Well, I have stayed at it. I've stayed at it for 18 years. And I hope that old number 19 is up there with his flat top and maybe his black high tops on. And I hope he knows that I have stayed at it, and maybe he's even a little proud of me. There's just something about 18 years. 18 is a good number. And today, I retire from pro football.
Well, Manning won 2 Super Bowls, 1 each with the Colts and Broncos. He was nicknamed the Sheriff, so this last Super Bowl was his last rodeo, they say. He was the league's most valuable player 5 times. He collected 200 wins, including playoffs, and, of course, that last one coming in Super Bowl 50. Beyond the numbers and the production on the field, the fact that he helped 4 head coaches reach the Super Bowl, his legacy will be his ability to put the game back into the hands of the quarterback, make it more of a passing game.
Wow. Well, thank you so much to Jim Stevenson for bringing us that overview of Peyton Manning's really incredible career. Thanks so much, Jim.
You're welcome.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Your director today was Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Zaina Abdulrahman. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you want to contact us, you can find us on Twitter. We are at @VOA_IE. My handle is @Michael_Lippin. And Jim Stevenson, what is your handle?
@VOA Stevenson.
All right, so please follow Jim as well. Let us know what you think of Peyton Manning. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
March 8th is International Women's Day, celebrated by the United Nations since 1975 and adopted by a UN resolution in 1977 as United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace. It is a day to reflect on women's progress, call for further change, and acknowledge the courage and determination of women working for gender equality around the world. It is also an opportunity to raise awareness about the struggles of women and girls the world over. Struggles for education, for equality before the law, for access to basic services that men take for granted, such as access to banking or training, and adult education. In too many cases, women struggle for basic respect, and in the worst cases, they struggle to be seen not as the property of anyone, but as a free and independent person. The fact is that although women and girls have made great strides in the past 41 years, they still have a long way to go. Nowhere in the world can women claim to have all the same rights and opportunities as men. The majority of the world's poorest people are women, and their work is less valued. They receive 30-40% less pay than men for doing the same work. Their lack of economic power sometimes translates to powerlessness in other aspects of their lives as well, where they disproportionately suffer from gender-based violence. That is why this year's theme is Planet 50-50 by 2030, Step It Up for Gender Equality. A part of the United Nations 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, it is an all-out push to implement a number of United Nations commitments on gender equality, women's empowerment, and women's human rights. This includes goals such as ending all forms of discrimination against women and girls everywhere, eliminating all forms of violence against women and girls, stopping all practices specifically harmful to girls, such as child, early and forced marriage, and female genital mutilation, and ensuring that all girls and boys receive a quality primary and secondary education. Any society hoping to flourish must begin by empowering its women and by promoting for them the same rights that men already enjoy. On International Women's Day, we celebrate and honor women and girls and commit ourselves to making the world a place where women and girls are not excluded or marginalized, but are free to realize their full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.